everybody, and welcome especially to Dino. Dino, as I mentioned before, is a Berkman Fellow, been working on a number of different projects here at Berkman over the course of the past year, has also worked on our youth and media project in the past. He recently completed his oral defense of his PhD, which is an exciting milestone. He's been a really amazing media producer for a number of very impressive outlets, of which you can see in his bio listed on the website. And he's here today to screen his film for us. Are you going to take us through the agenda for it?
Yes.
Off to Dino. Thanks.
So I'm going to do a quick intro to the film. First, thanks for being here. I'm going to do a quick intro to the film. We'll show it. Then I'll do a quick wrap-up, and then ideally you'll have some questions. And ideally I'll have answers. That would be great. So again, my name's Dino. I'm a fellow here, but I used to be a Berktern, so welcome. When I was a Berktern, I was a poor student. Now I'm just a poor, slightly older graduate. So there's hope for all of you. So I want to thank Amr for organizing this with Carrie Anderson. I want to thank Dan Jones, who's always helpful with me for video. I want to thank Urs Gasser, of course, the great executive director of Berkman. I also want to thank Sandra Cortesi and Nathaniel Levy, who I've worked with a lot in the last couple of years, who have been only kind and highly supportive and encouraging with whatever I've done here. So thank you so much. It was recently Father's Day, so I think for a lot of us, you'd reflect on your parents and particularly your father. And I was really lucky as a kid. My father was a hairstylist, as you could probably tell by my hair. And so I spent a lot of time with him. I'd get on my little hands and knees, and we had those revolving barber chairs, so I'd wipe them down and shine them up. I'd go in the back of the salon and clean the little coloring bottles you'd use to do people's hair. I'd sweep up. I'd wash people's hair occasionally. It was a lot of fun. One of the best things I liked about being with my dad is I got to watch someone who really loved what he did, and it was really inspiring to see someone who's so focused and really enjoy what he did as a role model for all of us. I think it's a great thing to see your parents loving what they do. But then also, being a hairstylist, obviously it's about doing hair, but it's also about establishing relationships. And literally, when you have a hairstylist, people will literally come in off the street. And so my dad was really good at befriending people. And a lot of times, these people who literally came off the street would become friends for decades. And I have a little bit of that at my best times. One time, specifically, I was in Los Angeles, and I met a woman named Maria. She was a maid at a hotel. And we just started talking, and then over the course of our time, she spoke about how she grew up impoverished in Mexico. She met her husband there. They decided to make the jump to the U.S., and about the trials and tribulations of immigrating to another country, and about how wonderful that was. And it was just a fabulous story. And if you saw her on the street, she seemed just like a regular person. And it was really interesting to see someone who just any one of us has these great stories. When I think about Maria and the relationship I have with her, I think about my dad and my uncle, as well as Maria. All of them have this sort of good ability at making people feel important and good, and the burdens of our lives lift up. If you ever met my uncle, and he's the fellow who's a focus on this video, he's a very unassuming guy. He's a barber. And if you went to his salon and he cut your hair, again, you'd feel really good about yourself. But I find sometimes when we have those relationships, we often don't ask the other people where they came from and how they got to where they are. So this video I'm going to show you, it's called Home, is a little story about my uncle and his simple, quiet life. Let me get out of here for a second. Every winter, as the winds grew cold and howled over old Lake Chipikin, I would always visit my uncle Victor, and he would share with me wonderful stories about the old country, his family, his friends. But no matter how much we spoke, he would never say why he left and never returned. So I decided to find out for myself.
Cousin Franco asked me when Victor would come to visit. And all I could think of in the middle of all this laughter and all these wonderful people, is it seeing this is the closest he'll ever come to being back home. There's nothing I can do.
That's me. That's my life.
If you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about the context for it. So just really briefly to recap. So I was in Europe staying with a high school friend of mine, Connor, and I phoned my uncle and I said, Victor, you have all these great stories from when I was a kid, but we never really talked about, you know, actually going to where you grew up. And he said, basically go to Trieste and take a bus or a train or a car and go down this peninsula, then go east, and you're going to see a canal. Go to this town, knock on a door and say, my name is Dino, Carlo is my dad, Victor is my uncle, are we related? And so I literally took a bus and went and did that. And it wasn't the first house, but literally it was the second house I went to. That woman, Marina, my girlfriend, came out. So it was literally the second house. During the trip, I was there for eight days in total, but after about five, I was going to leave. I'd packed all my things, I was ready to go. And then I thought to myself, I hadn't still quite figured out why my uncle left. And then a little bit after that, like a day or two afterwards, I spoke to Marina, again, the old woman who's my girlfriend. And after talking to her, I was thinking to myself, if I came back in a year or two or whenever, and if she's old enough, obviously, that people unfortunately pass, if she left, I'd be really sad. And I don't think the place would be complete, and I don't think I'd enjoy being there. And then when I thought about that, I went, oh, okay, now I get it. My uncle, because of his age, you know, a number of people just passed away from natural causes. A number of them just migrated out. And then the people that are still there, they look a little bit different. The city's changed. And then when I came to that realization, I went, I don't have the full story, obviously, because it's my uncle's story. But I had an appreciation for why he left. Logistically about the actual shooting. So I was there for 8 days and I shot about 9 hours of footage and I shot another 4 back here in North America. For those of you who are, for those of you who are good in languages, so I'm originally from Canada. My first language is English. My second language is French. And so I had a dictionary and a verb book. So when I was talking to them or interviewing them, I'd have a sentence I'd think of and I'd think of the words and I get some couple of nouns and a couple of verbs and I'd kind of conjugate them in structurally like in French. And I think if you notice some of the times I was asking questions, they're kind of like a French English amalgam. And so over the course of the time, I spoke better and better Italian, although it wasn't great. And so then sometimes when I'd be interviewing them for a long time, like sometimes it would just take a long time to talk to them about their stories. And so I'd ask them the questions. And then they'd answer, and because my Italian's not my first language, I was like, I think they're saying something that matches this question, but I'm not exactly sure. So then eventually I have, again, 9 hours of Italian footage, 4 hours in English. And so for those of you at video edited, you can put like a loop. So I was like, io mi chiamo Dino. And I would look in I would look to find out what io is. I'd find mi nome Dino, and then I would do the subtitling. It literally took me, like I could have got someone to transcribe it, but it just didn't feel right because this is obviously really highly personal. It would take me about an hour per minute of subtitling. So literally just for like that's like 24 minutes. So it would literally take me a day just to do subtitles. It got so bad one time. I had a friend of mine, Lauren. I phoned her on a Thursday and I said, hey, Lauren, I'm feeling a bit squirrely. And she said, well, what was the last time you were outside? And I said, oh, that would be Sunday. So I would get up. I would edit all day, I'd go to sleep, I'd get up and rinse and repeat, and it would go on for a long, long time. So this was overtly something for myself and my family, and then I showed it to mixed groups. When I brought it to my uncle, I felt kind of like, you know, like when a bird goes back to the nest, like the mama or papa bird brings back like a worm. I felt kind of like that. I was bringing something back that was a gift. And so I got my uncle a VCR and we played a tape and he didn't really like it so much. And again, sometimes you come to these realizations that take you a little while. And I think part of it was that, again, the people that he knew, a lot of them were gone. There's a picture towards the end. There's like a black and white photo of this gentleman, and then they show him with a microphone. So, you know, this guy, he hadn't seen him for years. And so seeing these things, I think, is a bit harder. And especially generationally, you know, he grew up before television. And I think even if you did, it would still be pretty bizarre. So I just finished my oral defense for my dissertation, which was great. And I end up, this is kind of the extra for this. I've been using that with classrooms in New York. And so I have kids, myself and a teacher will share visual media like this and photography, and then they'll be talking about their immigration experience. And it's been a lovely, lovely experience. I've had a lot of really emotionally honest and touching sharing by a lot of kids in New York City. And it's been fabulous. And part of the reason I did that was I'm an adult. I know a little bit of my family's history, not as much as I'd like. And obviously because of some of the issues here, they're really hard to try to broach. I find my uncle, I haven't lived in the same city as him for a long time. And so, you know, when you're with relatives for a couple of days, you don't want to, oh, let's go really deeply into our family history. You want to just enjoy your time with them. And then this felt like I had to sort of unpeel some layers of some things I think I should have spoken to him about, and eventually I have. So that's basically all I have for this. If you do have any questions, I also have these pens and pencils and these sheets, if you want to pass them around if people haven't filled them out. This is like a rough cut, so it's just been like loosely edited. So if you have any suggestions about it, please feel free to write them on the form. And if you have any questions in terms of a Q&A, please raise your hand and I'll do my best to address whatever questions you have. And thanks for watching. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
One, is he still really determined that he's not going to go back and see these people who you filmed? And two, is your the story of your father, why he left, more straightforward?
I'm convinced he won't go back.
Okay.
There's something, again, it was my thoughts about Marina when you know how, like, genetically, I think we're very similar to our relatives. I think we're very, there's almost this pristine nature to what he left. That's this really nice integrated whole. It's almost like you have a present that's wrapped up. And I think he's finding that he just would rather leave it at that. And I know he won't go back, especially with my father deceased. He won't. And you know how you have like siblings. My father was the much more adventurous traveling type, and my uncle's more of a stay at home guy. The second question. Oh,
your father, was the story of him leaving more straightforward, you should understand?
Yeah. And so when he was working, he did some more manual labor that he didn't like. I think, when he was there in Italy back in the old days, economically it wasn't doing very well.
He never went back either, right?
No. So.
I'm curious about your relationship to the camera. I think some of the conversations are just so intimate that you're having with your family. So just in those moments, how you kind of negotiated your relationship to the camera, and also how did you negotiate the camera with your family members?
Yeah, it was funny. So I did a media program. I think there's something where you're into media and you're into stories, you can get so into them that, and maybe in retrospect, they don't seem as tactful as you'd like. So if I was there for 8 days, and I shot about 9 hours of footage, so it would be about an hour a day. So most of the time I did just chat with them. It's weird being a visitor for people that you don't know, especially if they're related to you. It literally felt like there was a scene, Euphemia, she was the first person that really spoke on camera. And she's like, oh, I look enough like my dad. And no one came back. And I look enough like him. So it's like, like the cliche line, it's like an elephant in the room. So there was something the whole time where we all liked each other. We all like very, I think our family just likes to goof around and have fun. And so we're there. I'm newly there. I don't know them. So I'm trying to ingratiate myself, enjoy the company. And then I felt inclined because of my uncle to start asking questions, but it took a long time. And so again, similarly, in terms of the integration of the camera, it was more of a slow migration. And yeah, and people, I think they understood what I was doing, and I think they appreciated it. And again, it's weird where, for my family members, I speak French passably well, and I'm, I guess, the slightly more adventurous one. Like I'm studying in the U.S., so I felt it as well. It's almost like this artifact. And when I talk to them about it, it's like a family artifact for them back home, because I don't know if they'll ever come. And so I think all those things sort of made it, integrating it made it simpler. Although obviously it is a bit problematic. So, thank you. Hi.
Well, what kind of relationships did you establish with people of your generation in this family?
We seem like collegial, like we're pretty friendly with each other. It's strange. I don't have any kids. The ones at my, and I'm not married. So I perceive there's a little bit of a gap linguistically and also life-wise.
I just mean sons and daughters of your father's generation. That's what I mean by your generation.
Yeah. The ones that were of my age were, again, just linguistically is a little bit different. And then I think because of their life roles, again, the ones that were of my age, like it was Roberto, the one who's talking about in 1918, the Italians came. So they're around my age, but because of the marriage and the children are there's a little bit of gulf. I mean, we got along. Everyone got along really well, really, really well. And I felt people were really generous throughout the time because, again, it's like I just happened to be there. And it was funny where it was as provisional as, so this bus goes and loops. And so I get dropped off. And it's so strange. Like, so I've been in Europe for a little while. I had my typical European knapsack. I have a still camera and a video camera, and it's like August, so it's really hot. So I start walking, and there's this path, like there's a divergence, and I'm like, I hope I pick the right one because I don't want to sleep in a bush, like because I don't know if I'm going to find anyone. So I literally went, and you start to take these chances, and I think they kind of appreciated the fact that I was adventurous enough to find them. So
you leave the post-production the way it is, or do you plan to refine it? Because I think the way it is, it's very raw, but I like it that way because I think it conveys that sort of personality, like close intimacy that you would lose if you had high level of production, because you said it's not finished yet, it's a very raw version. I really like that. And I also was wondering, you put the revelation that it's actually Sošići are in Croatia, you put that in the end on purpose, right? And you plan to leave it there. I think it's an excellent effect, because all the time I know that it's Croatia. So all the time I was thinking, why are you talking about Italy?
Yeah.
When it's Croatian. But then I think that was a really powerful effect, because it really conveys something that is very specific to that area. And that is that conflict that always draw people away.
And it's interesting, when I grew up, so my father and my uncle, before they left, it was Italy. And then it's something that they just never broached. Like, there was never once in my entire life they said, oh, by the way. And then it's strange where in my dissertation, I have these prefaces for the chapters. And so it's about, the one preface is about them in the war and dealing with some of those issues and leaving. And later on, it talks about their integration into the Canadian community. And then it's the legacy of immigration. So it's partly once a narrative anecdote is about my sister playing basketball, and then my dad, he's driving them home from basketball, and he said, hey, girls, they just won a game, so they're all jumpy. He's like, stop acting so dumb, D-U-M, dumb. And so they start giggling because he spelled it incorrectly. And it's strange where, so we have these immigrant pasts, and you embrace them, but at the same time, you can sort of push parts of them away. And I found when I was a kid, there's certain things I think I should have asked that I never did. And there's certain things they didn't want to broach. For obvious reasons, they're really pretty loaded. And then again, it's very strange. It's like I find these things almost, we're genetically similar. I've been socialized a certain way. I'm one of those types I like to have people happy. And I think, again, my dad, my uncle are in a service industry. My sister is a principal. They're in industries where they try to have people get along. And it's really hard to say, hey, kids, one day, oh, you're 12 years old, let me tell you the tale. And it just never got talked about, which is, again, it's very strange. But given my family context and the way that we socialize with each other and the way that we are, it's strange.
You've mentioned that you were using this film as a part of a learning experience in the classroom. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
So I've had the great pleasure of working in New York City schools for the past several years. And so I thought about this video and how much I learned about myself and my background of my family And I thought, how can I have kids do this? And so I've embedded the video, some photographs from it, and some other visual media into the social studies curriculum in New York City. And so we'd share, myself and this teacher would share a series of lessons, like where we'd have mapping exercises, and we'd talk about Ellis Island, we'd do drawing exercises, they'd bring in artifacts. And then from that, I focused on a couple of case studies. One girl is from she's an immigrant, 10 years old. The boy, who's also 10 years old, is a natively born American. And it's just them talking about the idea of immigration and exploring their emotions. Because unfortunately, schools, because of the accountability era, exploring emotions doesn't seem to be, in a lot of places, very, very important. And with now, with teacher merit pay being based on English language arts scores and literacy scores, it becomes really difficult to do those things. So I've been really happy to be able to do that. One of the things I found that I like about it, the class I was working with specifically for my dissertation was 21 students, 17 of which were second language learners. And it's almost like, you know, when you read in a foreign language, there's this cognitive load, like it gets very heavy. And then if you ask them to write, it can be also as heavy. What we would do is interleave things where they would read in English, and again, being second language learners, and then they'd write. And sometimes the writing wouldn't be as thorough or as involved because of, I think, the cognitive load is so heavy. Then conversely, we'd be trying it with the video. And then because a lot of them are English language learners, like second language learners, the video, the photographs, the artifacts they brought in would really elicit like much more in deep writing and very emotionally candid and honest stuff. Like to a point where I was worried that it might become too honest and too deep. And I'm an educator. I'm not a psychologist. So I was worried that I could get into issues that would be. But luckily, they were all like, the stories that I heard were really touching, but they were something that I felt in the context of a classroom were something that it was okay to talk about. And similarly, it was really nice is that the kids, when they share their artwork with one another, they were really respectful. Like, it was really, really nice to see. And I find in a lot of situations with adults, but also with kids, when you think about them in the best way possible, they seem to respond in kind.
Second, in terms of how you are, you know, continuing to edit your film, I too really responded to the revelation. I did not know the history of the place, except all of the extra hooks and dots and all that stuff led me to believe that there was something going on. I would really love to see not only personal narrative, but some more social political kind of information, because I think that is another thing that so much of the immigrant story work that I am privy to is emphasizing the coming to the States, right? But what about understanding the shifting terrains of your nationality? That is very unique and interesting and could potentially give the students a whole different kind of set of tools in addition to processing the emotion and, you know, telling your own stories.
We were talking about in the defense how from my uncle's generation, it seems like when you leave your nation state, it's almost like it's like a binary where it's like you're either home or you're away. And now it's the membrane separating the two seems much more permeable. Like, as an example, I'm here as a student from Canada, which, you know, doesn't seem that big a deal, but it's what it is. And I think there's a lot of people in this room that are probably from other countries, and having a bi-national or tri-national identity seems to be more and more of a common occurrence. Similarly, the kids I work with, although socioeconomically they're not, it's a Title I school that I was working at, a lot of them travel more than I would have thought. And then maybe I was a captive to the fact that there were seven kids in my family. We would travel almost not at all. Like, we would travel to our farm, and we would go play in the fields and pick up potatoes. Like, that was our traveling. And so now there's a lot more of, like, with people's disposable income and some of the choices they make, there's a lot more traveling. And we did some mapping exercises where kids seem to have, again, their identity isn't as fixed as it might have been back in my uncle's generation. Because it's more permeable, navigating at least two nationhoods. So,
I think reflecting on an earlier comment, also watching your movie made me want to learn more about your dad. It's almost like he's in you know, it's a bit of a question mark. Like, you focus on your uncle, obviously, because he's alive and he has stories to tell, but there's a bit of a mystery about your dad, and I don't know if that was, you know, conscious or on purpose, but that definitely raised a question when watching the film.
It's interesting how these narratives play out. Like, I've read somewhere in terms of journalism, once you write, okay, so when you have a story, it could turn into an infinite number of possibilities, but once you have your first sentence, it fixes into a really limited number of things. I found for this, like, just again, I'm just explaining the way it went, as opposed to, like, I'm not apologizing by any means. The story felt best that it was my uncle's journey, but then it was me on his behalf doing the journey, so there's almost like this dual protagonist. And I did a cut before where I was at the end, and I think it found it was a bit jarring because I'm really not seeing, because the camera's kind of my identity for most of this. That's something interesting where I'd like to explore. That's a great idea, like exploring my father's background and his transition. Like, it's touched on very lightly, like to a point, like, I could say it was touched upon because it was, but it was like very much in passing.
Why did he leave? And then you say that he wants your uncle, his brother, to come. But I couldn't help asking myself, oh, but why did your dad leave in the first place? And what was his life in Canada?
And luckily, when he came over, at the time, things were more financially secure. And, you know, they were worried. It's so funny when you hear these things. They had a massive distrust for banks. So they would do things like digging holes in the backyard and putting lots of cash in the backyard because they're afraid that banks would be nationalized. Like, obviously in Canada or the U.S. and a number of countries that hasn't happened, but they were worried because of their history. And they're doing this, you know, a lot longer in their lives than they should have. They should have went, oh, things are pretty stable here, so we can put money in a bank. It's fine.
He took this trip and did all this for your uncle? Did he specifically ask you to, or did you just decide this was a thing you were going to do for him in a way that was really kind of more about you? Because I would love to see that explore. At least my impression from the film as it stands is that he didn't necessarily exactly say, hey, I would really like it if you did this thing for me, but more just sort of acquiesced and gave you enough information to find the town. And I would love to see that tension explored more.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There is, I think, in the write-up for this, it is this tension between an older generation's wanting to move on and we wanting to find out. And there's something about leaving a place. Like these days, again, the people that are in this room that are from another country, I'm assuming have come here by choice. At those times, and some of the reasons touched upon about this video, it's not necessarily forced, but it is in some extent. They were classified, my father was classified as a refugee when he came over. So you could say he was forced. I would totally acknowledge what you're saying. Like, he didn't say, hey, do you have a camera there? Go and shoot a video for me. And it was one of those things that as I've gotten older and you have these questions about identity that you explore when you go to college. Up until that point, I just, there's this love, I don't want to say hate, this love, this attraction, repulsion to your past, and it took me until I was in college to want to explore that. And then part of it was I have some facility making stories, and this is an interesting story to talk about. And then how do I get my uncle to talk about these things? It's difficult. And in a lot of ways, I wanted to talk to him and them. There's a reason why I was there for 8 days. Like, I wasn't there for two. And part of it was, it's a slow integration into... And then it was, oh, Dino, you're the son of Carlo, who you've not seen for a long time. I'm feeling very emotional. So everyone's like, there's something going on. Everyone knows we should talk about it sometime, but no one wants to. And that tension's a bit... I have that tension with my uncle, but not quite as acutely because he sees me every year. So,
so when this started off, I was thinking I'm watching an episode of Who Do You Think You Are? And we have the whole setup with the family mystery that you're going off to solve. And especially when you got into the World War II stuff, I said, oh, it's going to turn out that the family was fascist or communist partisans or something else, or there's an illegitimate birth or something like that. And then we end up with nothing as the answer at the end. So is this kind of a conscious effort on your part to counteract that family drama genealogy show and say something different about the way families work?
I think the departure was based on, you know, things are going down here, we need to leave, like in Europe at the time. In terms of, like, so again, so I'm like captive to what my uncle would say. And so when he tells stories, again, the intro, the first chapter for this dissertation is about them leaving and about how there is some fascists coming into their town. So how do you deal with that? And then they're left with this point where we're not particularly, my uncle's not particularly political, but if you feel unsafe, if you worry that if you see people getting killed, there's a tendency to make a really hard decision. I don't know how complicit he was in that in terms of his background. I don't think he was. At the age, he was pretty young. And that community seems very much, it was just a very rural community that unfortunately was in the wrong place.
I, it was more that your show, your movie tends to set up for some dramatic reveal, which never happens. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as if that's intentional or not.
Which is really interesting to me. I mean, I also have a World War II era relative that I pester about stories all the time, and who just does not want. And it was the worst thing because it's my grandmother, and my grandfather had dementia before he died, and for a while he spent the last couple of years in 1944, like permanently. So all he wanted to talk about was the war, and you could just see it was like she was gonna lose it. Like, I think it might just be a World War II thing. Like, people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to relive it.
I really saw it a little differently from that. I mean, I saw it that originally I think he posited the issue in order to understand why my uncle doesn't want to go back. And I suppose it could have been your father, too, if he was still alive. In order to understand that, I have to understand why he left. But I think it turns out that, at least in part, it has nothing to do with why he left. It has to do with the fact that his brother is gone. And his brother was a point of referral to him. It was his older brother, right? 2 years older. His brother brought him over to the States, right? Or to Canada, right? And it's just too painful for him to confront or to want to do anything because this older brother won't be there. That's the way I took it. Maybe it has to do with my own family dynamics. Yeah. I don't know, but curious to know how much that rings true to you or whether I'm forcing the evidence.
From one of the questions from earlier on, with my father being passed away, that was like, if there was a chance for my uncle to go back, it stopped when my father passed away. And yeah, I think like my uncle's more like, you know, sometimes people live more interior lives. And again, maybe I'm stretching the analogy, but it's like he has in this box of his memories that's been sort of adorned with his relatively poetic ways of describing it. He has some good memories and bad, and I think he doesn't want to change those things because of the emotional difficulties he's had in the past. And then without my father to nudge him along, like if my father had lived longer, I think he might have gone back. You know, there's a dynamic there that my dad's more of the let's go, and then I don't know if my uncle would feel he had a choice not to go. But with my father gone, there's no way he would go. So, yeah, go ahead, please.
The people who stayed, who you visited, you know, they're a remnant Italian community in what's now Croatia. Do they basically live their lives as if Croatia wasn't there and it's still Italy? Mm-hmm. I mean, does it matter a whole lot to them that where they live is not part of Italy?
No, I think they've just embraced their present. So it's easier for them. We had to speak in Italian the whole time because of my background in French. And so they would speak Italian to each other a fair bit when I was there.
Right. Do they live their lives in Italian?
For the when I was there, they were
right. But
and they would like, you know how there's certain parts, like that area was relatively touristy, and so they'd have a lot of people from Germany being tourists. And so, and then there's this thing where they would speak multiple languages. So I think there's this thing where they kind of go back and forth. Oh, and just hold on, just for people's time checks, it is 1:30. I'm more than willing to stay, but I know sometimes people have to go and do things, so please feel free. I won't be offended anyways.
Everyone speaks Italian, and the Croats speak Italian, and then those of Italian origin also kind of speak Croatian, so it's all, but Italian is widely spoken, and they watch all their television in Italian. My friends from there, basically, Italian is their second language.
So it's as if they were not, as if they were still in Italy.
So it's so blurry, they really don't, there's no... It's kind of malleable.
Is that true all the way down the Dalmatian coast?
I don't know, but in Rovinj, where Sochi is close, it certainly is.
Yeah,
and it's interesting how those things would play out. Like, again, there'd be a sort of a higher, I would assume there'd be a higher preponderance of people speaking Croatian the further you go down the Dalmatian coast, okay. And then...
What the instructions you had to how to get in touch with your family... Because it seems like that's the kind of instruction one would give in 1930 or something. I mean, are they not in touch at all?
You would think I would get a phone number, but I literally had just directions to go to this, go down this peninsula, and there's a canal there. Go east, young man, and you'll find, maybe you'll find someone.
So how did they get the picture, actually? How did they receive the picture?
My father would have mailed them back.
And they have an address somehow.
Yeah.
He had one.
Yeah.
Which he didn't give you.
Yeah, if you look at a map, it's like one of those, like I've looked in maps subsequently, it's one of those towns that's so small, it's like, it's not on a regular map. Like, it's that small. Like, it's a town, I think that the total population is, I think it's 500 the last time I heard. So it's like something where if you have, like, well, there's a scene showing some maps and you can't see it there. So it's that small.
The conclusion of the film, what your uncle says basically in the final sentence as why he didn't go back, seems like what he's saying is the reason I won't go back is that I don't think I have the resilience to readjust to coming back again. So it seems like maybe that would be an entirely different story, but it's the story of adjusting to the new place is what he doesn't want to have. Coming back again is what he can't do. Not necessarily going back, it's coming back again.
Yeah, the leave taking is very difficult. Like, for myself, it was hard, as you see in the documentary, and obviously for him back in the day, where it was hard for me knowing that although some of the older people I might not see in a subsequent trip, I'll see most of them. For someone like him back in those days, those journeys are pretty profound. Like, and again, he's not the traveling type. I think he really thought, you know, I'm not going to go back. And he hasn't. So,
when are you going back?
I might go in a month. Yeah, so that should be fun.
And show this film.
Yeah, I hope I can find the village again. Any more questions?
Online for free.
We can talk. this is, again, I really appreciate the oral feedback, but if you have any written thoughts, please write them down on those sheets that I don't have any more of, but they're around here. So, yeah, and I really appreciate, like, the rawness of it, I think, matches the emotion. Like, if it's actually better, I think, that it's slightly handheld. Like, it's relatively static for handheld, but it's, yeah, you can tell it's like someone's behind the...